Thursday, the 4th of March, Yud Ches Adar, Dr. Yossi Adler, how should we approach genetic screening?
Thank you for inviting me once again. I've chosen a topic this time, which is perhaps whereas previously we've spoken about halachic issues and issues which have got clear halachic imperatives and maramakonas. This topic is much more vague, and the halachic basis for making decisions in these areas is perhaps totally more on what one would describe as Das Torah rather than clear-cut halachic imperatives. I initially thought about quite a wide, broad range topic, and then I think I realized it got a bit too big, that there's a huge amount of interest in what's called traditional genetic screening, which we've been busy with now for many years and which everybody's aware of, which is the question of Tay-Sachs screening, Day-Sharon screening, pre-Kiddush screening, to try and avoid having couples getting married or carrying certain diseases, and as a result of that having children or a high chance of having children who are unwell. And what we can do to prevent that, and how far should one go to prevent that. Then there's a separate issue, which is the issue of screening for conditions which are recognized in people, which are not really necessarily to do with their children as such, but even themselves. And that is, it's come particularly to light with breast cancer genes, which have been found to be very common in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. There's the breast cancer 1 and 2 genes, which have an incidence of about 2.5% in Ashkenazi Jews, whereas incidence of 0.1 or 0.2% in the general population. So that means about 1 in 40 Ashkenazi Jewish men and women carry these genes, and they then have a much higher chance of developing common cancers, particularly breast and ovarian cancer in women, but also some cancers which become more common in men. How far should one go to look at these genes? And then I realized I think that cover both in one session is probably going to be too big an area to cover. Particularly the second area is very, very fraught with many discussions, and perhaps that should be left for a separate occasion. And what I really wanted to do now is focus on genetic screening, pre-Shidduch genetic screening, and give a little bit of the history of how this has come about, and what the issues are. And these issues are actually very important in terms of just general screening as well, as we'll see. In other words, blood pressure, having your blood pressure checked is a screening test, right? Having high blood pressure is not an illness, but it's a risk factor for developing other problems later on, strokes or whatever. So are you mechuyev to go and have your perfectly healthy person? Are you mechuyev to go and have your blood pressure checked? Or perhaps you should leave it alone, not worry about it. Worry about it if you feel unwell, then you can start worrying about things. And so that's really the issue which I wanted to focus on, is to what extent can you be blind, in inverted commas, to what's going on around you, or to what extent are you mechuyev to take precautions in protection of ourselves and our children. So the story started really when it was recognized that there are certain genes which are very common in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. It started with Tay-Sachs, really the one who pioneered this was Rabbi Eckstein, who unfortunately had several children with Tay-Sachs disease, and he was thinking, what can one do to prevent this? And to understand the principle, I've just put on this sheet just a basic basic plan of how genes are transmitted so that you can understand it. Got one for myself. And that is that we're talking now about recessive genes. Recessive genes means that for every characteristic which a person has, a simple single gene characteristic, there are in fact two genes in each cell which control that quality. So for if there's a certain disease, which is a recessive disease, then in every cell of a person's body, they've got two copies of that gene. So if they've got two copies, they could either have two healthy copies, or, and they're obviously perfectly healthy, or they could have one healthy copy and one unhealthy copy, which is the gene for the illness. And that person, if it's what we're calling a recessive gene, will also be perfectly healthy, have no symptoms of disease whatsoever. Or they can have two copies of the faulty gene, and if they've got two copies of the faulty gene, then they will be affected by the illness. And so what it shows on the top, on the top figure, is you've got a man and a woman, and they both carry the gene. The big R is the working copy of the gene, the small R is the one that's not working properly, and is causing an illness. So both husband and wife are completely healthy, but they both are healthy but are carriers. So they both carry, have one healthy gene, one unhealthy gene. If they then when they then have children, they can each give, they each give one gene to any of their children. So therefore, it's assuming that this occurs at random, and the lines didn't come out very clearly, but you can see the lines which join up. The egg of the woman will, each egg cell only carries one gene, and each sperm cell only carries one of the genes. When they divide, the egg gets one gene, each egg gets one of these two genes, and each sperm gets one of these two genes. So therefore, if this process occurs at random, the woman egg will be either healthy or unhealthy egg, the man's sperm will be either a healthy or an unhealthy sperm, and if they meet at random, if you follow the lines and they mix at random, there's four possibilities of what can happen. Either it could be that this random occurrence which occurs at the time of conception could be that the two healthy genes will combine, making obviously a completely healthy child. It could be that two unhealthy genes will combine, making unfortunately a child who will be affected by the illness. Or it could be that one healthy child, a healthy gene from the mother, or unhealthy gene from the father, or vice versa will combine, and therefore the child will also be a carrier like the parents, and therefore statistically, if you look on the second line, there's a 1 in 4 chance that the child will be completely healthy, and there's a 1 in 4 chance the child will be affected, or 50% chance that the child will be a carrier. If, on the other hand, on the second diagram, the carrier marries somebody who's completely healthy and does not carry the gene, then 50% of her children will be carriers, and the other 50% will be completely healthy, but none of the children will be affected, again, because of the randomness. We should stress, of course, that we're talking about statistics here. It's perfectly possible for somebody in the first parent's birth, they're both carriers, to have 10 healthy children. Only statistically, if you had 100,000 children, then it's very likely that 25,000 would be affected and 50,000 would be carriers. But when you're talking about small numbers, obviously, You can't say that 1 in 4 children will be affected. That's purely a statistical number, but it means that there is a significant risk. So the idea, obviously, is to try and prevent two carriers marrying each other. And the tests now are relatively simple to do, to test whether a person carries these specific genes which have been identified. And initially, the system was set up for Tay-Sachs disease, which has a carrier rate, and I've written the rate of the ones which Dr. Shoram tests for routinely now. The carrier rate for Tay-Sachs in the Ashkenazi Jewish community is about 1 in 30. So that means that at random, if there's a chance, if nobody is tested, there'll be a 1 in 900 chance that two carriers will marry each other. Because it's 30 squared, because the 1 in 30, each one has got 1 in 30 chance of being a carrier, and that one has then got still a 29 out of 30 chance of marrying somebody who's not a carrier. So therefore there's a 1 in 900 chance that a random shidduch without any testing would be affected, that they would both have Tay-Sachs, and then they would have 1 in 4 chance that their children would be affected. Cystic fibrosis is a little bit more common, about 1 in 26 are carriers, and that gives you a rate for about 1 in 650 or so. And then there are a number of others which are very similar. Familitis autonomia is also about 1 in 30, and then there are others which are less common. So that overall, if you add all these together, it comes out that about 1 in 300 shidduchim of the tests which they do, the Yeshorim finds are incompatible. So for all the testing they do, about between 250 and 300 are fine, and one out of approximately that number are turned out to be incompatible because they carry one of these genes, and we should stress that all of these diseases are extremely serious diseases. They either cause death at a young age, or certainly cause a very great degree of difficulty during life. There's one other condition which is much more controversial, and that's the question of testing for Gaucher's disease. Gaucher's disease is extremely common in the Ashkenazi Jewish community. The figure given there is 1 in 15. Because they're mild forms of it, it's probably even more common than that, perhaps 1 in 11, which means that about between 1 in 100 and 1 in 200 should of him would be affected by Gaucher's disease. But the controversy over testing for Gaucher's disease is that Gaucher's disease is a treatable condition. Number one, sometimes it's very mild and people can live into their 80s and 90s without any treatment. And even those who are severely affected, and some people are very severely affected and can become ill from a very young age, but it is now treatable with enzyme replacement. And there's a question of should we be testing for conditions which are treatable, and therefore you're sort of almost becomes a little bit eugenic. You're trying to keep these diseases out of the community, but they're treatable diseases. How far should we go? But in random screening, and those are test usually for Gaucher's, but they don't report the results. In other words, they won't tell you that Shidduch is incompatible if it's carried Gaucher's. But the reason they test for it is that people who have Gaucher's in the family, particularly if they've got severe form of Gaucher's in the family, they can ask for the compatibility for Gaucher's specifically, so that if they want to avoid Shidduch, they can do it without anybody knowing about it, and they can therefore get the information is available. That's the policy which they've got a committee which decides these policies. So what should we be interested in all this? Should we be worried about it from the Hashkofa point of view, from the Halacha point of view? Should we be worried about all this? And Mekofa is a Gemara in Yevamos. Gemara says, we know that there is genetics, such a thing as genetics. Lo yisa odom isha mimishpachas nefim. You shouldn't marry a family which has epilepsy, it's translated. We don't know exactly what it means, but there was some kind of genetic epilepsy which was recognized, and it's brought down the Gemara, and it's passed in both in Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, that one shouldn't marry into such a family for fear of one's children having it. So you see that even from the earliest times, there were concerns about what one's offspring would be like at the time of a marriage, that we are obliged to be concerned about what the effects of it would be.
That turns into a hereditary.
This is not epilepsy as we know it, and most epilepsy is not hereditary, but whatever, the Gemara identified some kind of condition, we don't really know what it refers to. That's not important for our purposes. What's important is that once the Gemara recognized that there was a genetic condition, it put an issue on marrying into that family. For the rest of it, we don't know what the genetics is, we don't know what the risks are. It's just brought down as if there's a chasoka of three times, that one should avoid marrying into that family. In practical halacha, the question comes up as far as the question of marrying close relatives. That's really where it came to a fore in previous generations. The problem is that the Gemara in Yevamos and in Sanhedrin says that there's a mitzvah for a person to marry his niece. And that is because, Rashi says the reason is because a person will be mechavad, there's a natural affinity between somebody who's in the same family, and therefore a person is will have more of an affinity to his sister, and therefore as a result of that, if he marries his niece, he'll be mechavad his ishta, and will be very good for shalom bayis. Tosa says it's an Indian of muzzle, that the family, within a family you share the same muzzle, and therefore it's a halacha which is brought down, also in its pasuk in the Rambam, the Rambam brings it down, that a person should marry his niece, it's a good thing to do. The Rambam says that's the Chamit Sorfa al Salim, doesn't just mean giving them stock or whatever, but it means actually marrying into your family, keeping things in the family. And the Rabbeinu B'chai in Pashas Chayasara brings down that when Avraham Avinu said Kielati Velamati Teilech, he says Zu Ashora LaAdam Shiyisa Isha Mibnois Mishpachte. It's Ashora, that person should try and marry somebody from within his family, and that's the halacha psukah in the pasuk. The problem is that Rabbi Yehuda Chachosid in his Tzavot to his children says Lo Yisa Adam Basachiv Basachosa. A person should not marry his niece. And all in Farshim asks, how can Ruth Anossi go against the Beferish Gemara, Beferish Halacha in Shulchan Aruch, and say, don't keep it? So the person in the judge, there's a Rav Klotzkin in Shuvah's Evan Horosha, Ravnberg brings down this Shuvah, and he says that the reason is that although it's mitzvah to do it for the reasons which he said, but Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi recognized that there were dangers involved in it, and he said it became quite clear to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi that when people marry within the family, there's an increased risk of having congenital abnormalities, and that's clear from what we said at the beginning, because if at random you've got any rare recessive gene within the same family, it's much more likely that somebody in the same family will also have the same recessive gene, and therefore there's a much bigger chance they'll come together. And we know that when first cousins marry, the risk of congenital abnormalities in children is about 4%, as compared to about between 1 and 2% in the general population. So there's a significantly increase in risk. And Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid recognized this. Ah, there's a mitzvah to do it. He says, there's an inyan of showing mitzvah lo yedo davara. But that's only if you do it mamish with the complete mitzvah, with all the with the complete kavana, the shei mitzvah, without any side issues involved in it. And therefore, that's why originally there was mitzvah to do it, because people could do it mamish l'shem shemayim. But with the Yerida Sadoris, and people would marry within the family for other reasons without a complete kavanah l'shem shemayim, so they wouldn't have the protection of shem mitzvah lo yeda davara. So therefore he says it's better to refrain from it because of the risks, because of the physical risks involved. So you see that even b'mokum mitzvah, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is concerned that the physical dangers, the risks, have to be taken into consideration, and as a result of that he's able to be mevatel this inyan, this which is brought down as mitzvah drabonah in the poskim, because of his concerns about it. The Divrei Chaim compares this to yibum and chalitza. Right, Be'ikat in, one should really do Yibum. The Ikar Takana is to do Yibum. But when it became clear that people were doing Yibum, wouldn't be doing it, Mamash of the right Kavonsim, Shem Shemayim, so the second they should rather do Chalitza. So this is the same kind of idea involved with this. So therefore we're talking about marrying close relatives, to be marrying a niece. So Ravon said you can't put an Issa on it if it's not one of the Surim of the Ithorot. You can't say there's an Issa involved in it as such. But the Lashon of Rishon Zalman is, he brings down Lashon of Savron, is Sikon HaBonim Begeder Chamiris HaKantim Issa. Putting your children in danger is the same as Chamiris HaKantim Issa in any other context, and therefore one should, he clearly discourages and one should avoid it at all costs as far as possible. It's interesting that the Divrei Chaim himself says that one doesn't have to be concerned about it as far as marrying first cousin concerned. He says, and he introduces what's really the key to the whole discussion. And he says, even though there may be some physical risk involved with it, but he says, bar a hecha olam noeg, see how people do it, and certainly in Hasidic circles it was very common for people to marry their cousins and their close relatives. And therefore, it says, since it's something which people do, you don't have to worry. Shikfa doshu be rabim, shoy mitzvah mashen. Something which people normally do, there's an inyan which is brought down, which is that Shbaruch Hu guards a pesi, somebody who's simple, who doesn't know the issues, and it's something which people normally do, then there's an inyan of given to doshu be rabim, shoy mitzvah mashen. Therefore, he says, you don't have to worry about what the scientists say and what the physical risks might be, because we've got the protection of this inyan of Shem Shem Hashem. So, and look into where is this inyan of Shem Shem Hashem? How far does this inyan of Shem Shem Hashem go to? I found this four references that I could find to the inyan of Shem Shem Hashem in Shas. One of them refers to the Gemara, the famous Gemara of Shalosh Noshim Shamshus B'Mok, the three women who've got a heter to use contraception because of concerns that because of whatever stage they're in, that they will have children who are unhealthy if they have children in that stage. That's the shit of Ramea. The Chachamim say, Achazu v'achazu m'shamish v'zgadag v'aleches, they're not m'shamish b'mok, they don't have a heter, u'min ha-shamayim yirachmu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help them, m'shom sh'nei ma'ashoyim et'soyim ha'shem. Another example is that there's a din, although there's a halachas about not having water which has been left uncovered, but the Gemara says in Avodah Zorah, Peter Eino ain't but shum gulli. If you had an open fig which was left overnight, you don't have to worry about a snake having brought eris into it, because, and the Gemara says, you can leave it, Eino choshish, mishum shenem af shem b'psalm Hashem. You don't have to worry about these things, there may be a slight risk, but shem b'psalm Hashem. There's halacha also brought down in Yevamos Ayin Beis about Mila. We know that because they didn't do Mila in the Midbar, that was understood that you need a north wind to heal from a baby should be healed from Mila. And therefore a Papa says that Yom HaTiv, if it's a cloudy day, or a Yom HaTishusa, when there's a day when there's a south wind blowing, you shouldn't do Mila on that day. But because there's a risk that it won't be healed, there's no north wind. But the Gemara says, Idna to Toshabe Rabin, Shem Sam Hashem, you don't have to worry about it, because of Shem Sam Hashem. And the fourth one refers to Hakaza, they used to do bloodletting. And the Gemara says on Tuesdays and on Fridays, you shouldn't do bloodletting because there's some kind of sakana involved in bloodletting on those days. But then the Gemara says, don't worry about it, you can do it, because Kim Dadoshu Be Rabbe, Shem Hashem Hashem, people do it regularly, and which Baruch Hu protects them, and Shem Hashem Hashem. And interestingly, Rashi brings down there that people do it on Erev Shabbos, the Hetzes do it on Erev Shabbos, I mean, not on Tuesdays, because since it'll make you healthier on Shabbos to be able to eat, you need to do the Hakaza before you can eat fish, and you want to eat fish on Shabbos, so it's a necessity to have this bloodletting before Shabbos, so therefore you're allowed to do it even though there's some risk involved. So the Trumas HaDeshen asks, really, he talks about the halacha that if somebody unfortunately loses two husbands, she's not allowed to marry a third time because it's considered to be a sakana for a third husband. And he says, does this halacha apply nowadays? Is there a chayta not to do it? And Trumas HaDeshen in Reshit Aleph goes into this question. And he says that it's halacha which is brought down, it's a sakana, and you have to be concerned about it. So he says, but then he brings down the Ezerua, which says that you don't have to worry about it because it's only a sophic sakana, and we see people who do marry and they live perfectly happily, and Shem Epsoim Hashem, and he applies Shem Epsoim Hashem to this question as well. So there's a Rukham Shem in Kalatara, Rishua Kalinsky, analyzed the tshuva of the Trumas HaDeshen. And because the tradition then goes on to say, because we're a small nation, it's very hard to find shidduchim. So if you can find a shidduch, you've got to go for that shidduch, and you can't make too many inquiries, can't make too many difficulties, because it's going to be too hard to find shidduchim. And because of that, you can say Shem Psalm Hashem. So it seems that the translation is saying that you can only rely on Shem Psalm Hashem b'makom hatzorah, where there's a great necessity for it, then you can rely on it, but not necessarily in other conditions. And he points out that of the Gemaras which we mentioned, two of them, it just says Shem Psalm Hashem. When it talks about eating the figs and being Mishamish B'Moreif, it just says Shem Psalm Hashem. When it talks about the Mila and the bloodletting, it says Kiven to Doshubei Rabim Shem Psalm Hashem. Since many people do it, that's why Shem Psalm Hashem. And he wants to say that it seems fairly clear from the children in the Trumas HaDeshen, that what he's saying is that if you've got something which is a very small risk, this risk of eating these figs or the risk of having abnormal children, those situations is very, very small, then you can just apply a general halacha Shem Psalm Hashem, don't worry about very small risks. When you're talking about larger risks, and it seems the Mila and the bloodletting was considered to be a larger risk, then you can't just say Shem Psalm Hashem. You can only say if you've also got two other criteria. One is that it's Mocham HaTzorah, if it's something which is necessary, and one is that it's Doshubei Rabim, it's something which a lot of people do. If you've got a combination of Mokhm HaTzorach and Doshubei Rabim, then you can say Shem Psalm Hashem even to cover larger risks. So if you try to apply that to this situation, it would seem that if we're talking about presumably risks, we said about 1 in 250, 1 in 300, that L'chaira is a very small risk. And the question is, why can't we just apply Shem Psalm Hashem? How do we get involved in this whole thing in the first place? Surely a risk of 1 in 300 and so many other risks in life, it would have been very logical when this was first established to say, Shem Psalm Hashem, why should we worry about it? Even if you say that the risk is a bit larger, you could certainly say that Doshbe Rabim, it's a normal thing, was always a normal thing to do without getting involved in the Shidduchim. And a Mokam HaTzorach, as we said, Shidduchim is considered a Mokam HaTzorach, although you could say that to have a Shidduch, if you can set up a program, having a Shidduch which doesn't involve these things, you're not going to rule out that many Shidduchim, and perhaps wouldn't fit into the criteria of Mokam HaTzorach. But when Ramosha's got a tshuva in Evan Ezra Chedek Talit, where they asked him about this, and he was very is clear about it. And he said, although there's an inyan of hisalach lefonai, tiyatomim tiyem Hashem elokecha, which is hisalach mo betzlimus, and you don't start looking what's going to happen in the future, you accept for the situation as it is. But since this is now easy to be bodek, he says somebody who is not bodek himself is kaskira soinayim. It's like closing his eyes, liris mashe esh liris, stopping himself from seeing something which is even to do it. And if chas v'shalom something bad can come out of that, then we have to avoid that. And we know that Rav Moshe was very aware of Shem B'tzom Hashem, because he uses it in other chivas in connection with smoking. He originally said that you can't put an issa on smoking because of Shem B'tzom Hashem. Obviously, I think that would change nowadays, but at the time, when the ritual was not so clearly identified. So why did he not apply Shem B'tzom Hashem to this? So there's a number of issues. One is that the Truma Sesh makes it clear that for Shem B'tzom Hashem to apply, you have to be a pesi. That means you don't understand the risks. If the risks are clearly defined and it comes into the public domain and public knowledge, then we can no longer say, you're a pesi, just get on with it, don't worry about it. Because once it's publicized and the risks are known, then you no longer have that protection. Then the fear becomes on a person to take into consideration the risks, because he now knows what the risks are. The Het Hashem Tzom Hashem is, don't worry about it if you don't know what's going on. And there's a whole shine, it seems to my focus in those rooms from a suggestion, where the Shem Tzom Hashem, for example, applies to a Talmud Chacham, who knows the issues involved. So that's one issue here, that it could be that the possum wouldn't have got involved in the first place. But once it's known and it's publicized, then they have to respond to that. The other thing is that it's clear from the Ritva, he says, that even if you hold, because of Shem B'tzom Hashem, he says, you're allowed to do a mila on a day when there's no north wind, but you're not mechuyev. If somebody says, I'm scared and I don't want to do it, he's not obligated to do a mila on a Yom HaMo'unah. So it's clear from the Ritva that Shem B'tzom Hashem is a heter, it's not an obligation. And therefore, it's open to debate and it's open to decide under what circumstances do you want to accept it or not. And Tzitzilez himself brings down, as far as marrying niece or cousins differently from Divrei Chaim, quite clearly says that if you see the effect in front of your eyes, and you see that by marrying first cousins is a high incident, you can't say Shem B'tzom Hashem. Shem B'tzom Hashem is get on with it and don't worry too much about it. But once it becomes very clear and common and you see that this happens, then you can no longer apply Shem B'tzom Hashem to it. But I think there's also perhaps one further aspect which is, I think, possibly key here. And that is, Shem B'tzom Hashem is that you don't have to worry about small risks. And on an individual basis, it's true that all these risks are small. And therefore, you would say, an individual shouldn't have to be concerned about it. But the poskim are poskiming from the community. For the community, as such, it's not a small risk. For a community, it's a cast iron certainty that if you don't have screening, you're going to have a certain number of cases a year of Tay Sachs, you're going to have a certain number of cases of dysautonomia, because we know that that's what happens. So it no longer becomes a 1 in 300 risk. It's 100% certain that from the Tzibur point of view, cases of this are going to occur. And therefore the Tzibur may have totally different obligations from a Yochet. And therefore there could be obligations from the Tzibur to set up these programs in order to protect the Tzibur. And that's why, very likely, that's why Shem B'tzom Hashem may not apply to something which is on a communal basis. Just a few words then. If one accepts that one should do the screening, how should that be done? And that's this controversy, obviously, which has erupted over Dor Yeshorim. There's two ways of doing this. The way that it was set up originally by Dor Yeshorim was that they wanted to avoid stigmatization. And if people have to go into a shidduch and say, we're carriers of Tay Sachs, and therefore we know our daughter's a carrier of Tay Sachs, and we want your son to be tested for it, if that's not a routine thing to be done, then people would be, there was a concern that people would put the phone down without thinking any further. But the degree of knowledge in the community was not enough to be able to people to understand the issues involved, and people are very, very worried about shidduchim, and that people would therefore keep away from shidduchim, even though there's no real risk, as long as both sides are not carriers. And therefore the Bosman decided that using the Dor Yeshorim method, where people get an anonymous number, and nobody knows, or nobody has to know who's a carrier or not. Obviously, if a shidduch gets rejected, then both people know that they're carriers for one of these conditions, but that doesn't have to affect any future shidduchim, because nobody has to know about it. It just becomes, as it has become very largely in most communities, just you have your Dayasharam test, you have your Dayasharam number, nobody needs to then know any further details. The other advantage is that it's comprehensive, and that over the years they've increased the number of screens that they do for other conditions which have similar instances, as we've said. And the other, as we alluded to before, is the other advantage is that people have specific problems in their families. For example, Gaucher's disease, or something called connexin 26, which is involved with deafness. They can ask for donor to include this and do the blood tests for them and for the other side without the other side having to know anything about it, and therefore they can, without having to go and say we've got this problem in our family, they can throw it into the pot, as it were, and therefore that's very, very protective for families who are involved, who do have problems, to be able to be caught up with this. And that's why certainly the original most of the posthum experience, I'll say even from the beginning of life, said this is the wrong way to go about it. He said, why are we creating ignorance in the community? We should be perfectly open, we should educate people, we should explain to them what carrying diseases means, and everybody should be tested. Financially you can save money that way, because if parents are tested for all this screen of genes, and they're both negative, they don't carry any of these genes, then there's no reason for them to have to test their children, because their children will all definitely be negative. If they're positive, then they could test their children, so you could reduce the number of tests being done. If you're using the Dayasharam method, every time, everybody has to be tested through every generation. And obviously, we should point out, you're never going to eradicate these diseases by any kind of screening, because the carriers are still going to be present in the next generation. You're only going to hopefully eradicate people having the disease, but you're never going to eradicate the carrier state. So in the next generation, the testing will have to continue in the same way. But if the people who are negative for this whole screen of genes have an advantage, that then they don't have to worry about getting all of their children tested. We made a big fuss about the money in the context of bringing up a family and sending the child to school and to yeshiva and to sin and making a chasana. I think £180 for a screen to eradicate these things is not really an issue which is going to break the bank. But nevertheless, people have made a financial case for saying that we should be, that just do open screening. So that's something which has to be weighed up, and the question is, at what stage is the community ready to be able to say, we understand this, most people understand this now, we don't really need Dayasharam anymore, we can just let people be screened for all these diseases. But I think a lot of people will still say that the way which has been set up, it works well, why not leave it as it is, and allow people this anonymity, allow people to get extra screening when it's necessary, without having to make it into a whole issue again. We're positive, can you go and be tested? And fair, it just becomes an extra issue rather than that. But that's a question, Hashkov question, which is possible as to weigh up. What you can't have is two systems working concurrently. And that's really the debacle which happened in Antwerp. And that is that people in Antwerp said, why should we spend however much money it was then on doing a Dayasharam screen? We can get screening done, get the parents screened, we can do it much cheaper, and we'll be perfectly open about it. We know it's only a carrier thing, and we'll do it that way. And the people in London who advocated the same thing. Problem was that what they did was they did their screening, and some came out to be positive. When they came out to be positive, they said, well, we don't really want to have to tell people that we're positive. It's too complicated. Let's go and get a Dayasharam test done. So they went and did Dayasharam after they'd already been screened. And Dayasharam suddenly noticed that whereas normally the rates of positive tests come in, as we've said, at about 1 in 15, 1 in 20, from Antwerp, a very, very high proportion of the tests that they did were positive. So either there was some terrible outbreak of genetic disease in Antwerp, or something very fishy was happening. So they realized that was happening, and obviously that, if you do that, then that takes away the whole purpose of Dayasharam. Because if only people who are being previously tested are having Dayasharam tests done, then it's no longer anonymous, because anybody who asks for a Dayasharam test, oh, you must be asking for it because you're already positive. And therefore the whole purpose, the whole thing falls away. And that's why regretfully, Dayasharam has to say we can't test any more samples from Antwerp because it ruins the whole system for the rest of the world if that's involved. So that's the story behind it. People think they were just being difficult, but remind them that's when they make you sign when you do it that you haven't been tested elsewhere, and people think that was just to make things difficult for people, but it's purely because of this because of this purpose, that if you can have people being tested by both systems, then it's not going to work. So therefore, if the Poskim, if the world decides that the time is to abandon the Yeshorim and to do it by open testing, then fine. But as long as the Yeshorim is being accepted by the Poskim, then it seems to me that the way forward has to be to continue with the Dei Sharon system and to cooperate with that, notwithstanding these disadvantages, because I think probably the simplicity of it, now that it's set up and understood, outweighs the possible drawbacks of it. So that's just a simple outline of genetic screening in terms of these genetic diseases. The other issues, which you mentioned, are very, very much more complicated. Perhaps we can discuss that on a future occasion, but it is amazing, really, that Baruch Hashem has been set up in such a way that these diseases now have become very, very much less common than they were. It's a big schus for Avraham and for people who set it up, but they have managed to set this up in the world and really reduce the incidence of these diseases so significantly. It's a shame we should all be zocher that many other diseases should also become historical, and that we shouldn't have to worry about them in the future, and we should all be zocher to give health. Well, BSG said it from here.